This is Jim Massey. Today I'm speaking with Josephine Dallam at her home on Fountain Green Road in Bel Air.
I think my grandfather was born in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up here where he met my grandmother. He was a doctor, and he met my grandmother at Medical Hole, which was Dr. John Archer's home.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that maybe Dr. John Archer's granddaughter might have been my grandmother's bridesmaid, mm-hmm. something of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
But that you know Medical Hall. Have you done Miss Anne?
Miss Barney had.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Of course, she's a very remarkable person,
mm-hmm.
and has a very beautiful house.
Now, so where were you born?
I was born right across the road, right across.
At Broom's Bloom?
Mm-hmm.
How did it get its name?
Well, there's a difference of opinion. We were led to believe that it was named Broom's Bloom because they grew broom corn. Because part of the tract, or maybe the same tract, is also called Sedgley, which would lead to that supposition. There is also the theory that a man named John Broom, who lived, I believe, in southern Maryland, named part of that Broom's Bloom. So I really don't know, and I have not searched it. I'm not good at searching titles and what have you, and I don't know how much of it would show up, really.
Mm-hmm.
But that place, the house, was built by my great-great-great-grandfather. Yeah, John Isaac Webster, whose son was Samuel and whose son was John Adams. And then when he was married, he lived at Sophia's Dairy for a while, and at least the oldest of his children, maybe more than one of his 15 children, was born there. You know Sophia's Dairy, where Mrs. Schmidt lives. And then I don't know, which is disgraceful, at what point in the pecking order my grandmother was born, but she was farmed out, as many people were in those days when there were big families. She was farmed out to live with her aunts up at Broom's Bloom, so that when she married Dr. Dallam, she was Josephine Webster. That's when it became a Dallam place. And my grandfather my great-grandfather married Sarah Webster. He must have been around the county somewhere. Well, of course, the Webster did certainly. And my grandfather married Josephine Webster, and my father married Harriet Webster. And my brother married Hope Harlan, whose mother was Ariel Webster. So they don't go very far afield. And each one was William Dallam, with no middle name.
Hmm. And what did your father do for a living?
He farmed Broom's Bloom. And then when the last of his uncles and aunts who lived at the Mount died, at Mount Adams died, which was 1912 or thereabouts, he bought that. That was when my grandfather married Josephine Webster. The place was divided. I mean, when my great-grandfather was married, when John Adams Webster was married, he divided, and he went to live at the dairy, and the place was divided, and he built Mount Adams. And then, when the last of his children died, my father bought Mount Adams from the rest of the collection, the assorted cousins and what have you, to keep it from going out of the family. And then in 1914, it was sold to the Reverend Calvin Dale Wilson, whose wife was Mary Webster from Webster's Forest. Now, she was not a first cousin. She was a collateral. She was not a descendant. And they owned it until 1970 or 71, when Dr. Wilson's son died, his only child died. And then My brother and sister-in-law bought it back. And my older niece lives down there now in one of the apartments in the big house.
Hmm.
It's the big house and the tenant house, and there are three apartments in the big house and then the tenant house.
Well, now, how big was your family, your brothers and sisters?
Just my brother and I.
I see.
And he turned a tractor over on himself almost 9 years ago. So he left a wife and four children, the youngest of whom was graduated last Sunday.
Mm.
And the youngest will be a junior at Marietta College this fall, and Billy farms, and then Katie's working at Bryn Mawr School in Baltimore, which she's an alumna.
Hmm. What do you remember about growing up on the farm?
Well, it seems sort of average. I mean, everybody else did, you know, and my brother and I started school at Calvary. The schoolhouse, you know, James Run at Calvary, just this side of Calvary, and that big bank.
Mm-hmm.
Just as you cross the run. Well, not quite where you can see it, but just a little south of it was Calvary Schoolhouse. And my grandmother was living there in Calvary. And a permission was obtained that we could go to school there because it was more convenient, because that was sort of the trail, you know, to go up to grandmother's and such.
Mm-hmm.
And we went there for just a little while, and then you went to Billingsley, which is on Wheel Road.
Mm.
If you think about it, you can easily tell that house was a schoolhouse. It's just this side of McPhail Road on the left.
Mm.
It's now a dwelling.
Mm-hmm.
And we went there, and then when I went to high school in the fall of 27, and things weren't crowded then, and people were amiable and decent, eliminate going in two directions, my brother got permission to go to Bel Air School. So he did the 6th and 7th grade in Bel Air.
Hmm.
While I was in high school, and then of course he finished high school.
Did you have things to do on the farm that you were given, say, chores and things?
Well, I don't think I worked very hard. I fed chickens, you know, and stuff like that. I never worked around the stable.
Mm-hmm.
We generally had a colored man. We had the same man for 19 years, I think, and then we had another very fine old man. Well, he wasn't so old. He seemed old, but he really wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't. I've never learned to milk. I used to think I should have, that when Billy would be late harvesting and so on, it would have been nice if I could have milked. But I didn't. And none of us likes to garden, which is not very honorable. It does seem as if when you live in the country should support you. And of course, we had chickens and we had a garden. And we had cows, of course, and we always made butter, and I still make butter. After my brother died, the cow died not too long after that, and I did not draw a comfortable breath until 2 years ago, and David called me up one day and said, "Aunt Josie, guess what's in the Aegis? A Guernsey cow," which we've been looking for. So we had to hot foot up to the top of the county, and the barn was in Pennsylvania, and the house was in Maryland, and we bought the Guernsey cow, who's the best cow we've ever had. So I now very happily can make butter again and have decent cream milk.
Mm-hmm.
To the best of my recollection, I have drunk 2 glasses of pasteurized milk. And that is all.
Hmm.
I drunk cocoa, but to drink a glass of milk that I wasn't acquainted with cow, I have not done, nor do I want to. I dislike both of them.
Hmm.
And I have not drunk them.
Hmm.
And we have some pigs now. We always, of course, had pigs, and we butchered, and I enjoyed butchering. And we're going to butcher next week, except we're going to take the hog across the river to have it butchered. But butchering was all, and this is not the time of the year to do it, but this is the time of the year when the pigs and butchering wait. But we always managed to have pigs to be butchered in December. And butchering is a very important part of the year. Some people butchered before we did, and you could swap help back and forth. You might even swap sausage back and forth. Mm. And to borrow a scalding kettle and get things done early in the morning, and there would be a... It would take several men to handle them. And one of our neighbors lives up the road, did live up the road here, was a very fine butcher, very fine opening pigs, and we'd butcher on a Saturday, and then by Monday we'd be ready to cut up the sausage and the lard. And I can barely remember grinding our own sausage, and for many years we still had the grinder, by whatever's become of it. But then we used to take it to the store out here, or to Henry Weisheit's store, and have the sausage ground. Of course, we always cut it ourselves and seasoned it, but we had it ground. Mm. And we made the lard, and puddings, and scrapple, and blancmange, which is a wonderful delicacy. And we have given away quarts and quarts of blancmange made from the pig's feet jelly, which is rich. It's good. Of course, it's made with cream, too, but it's that jelly. Mm. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not. Mm. But when you cook the pig's feet, and of course, a lot of people like to eat pig's feet. I don't. I admit that they're perfectly good eating. I just don't like them. The sweetest meat on the whole hog is the hock just above the feet. Mm-hmm. But you cook the feet on the skins and the head. Any of those will yield gelatin. Mm. And gelatin will be, it will be, a little lighter maybe than this floor. You couldn't call it colorless. Mm-hmm. And cook it till it's stiffer than you would make jello. Mm-hmm. And then you melt it and put in the cream and sugar and vanilla, and that's your blancmange, and put it in a mold, and it's just delicious. Mm-hmm. And you do the same thing with cider or with wine. Mm-hmm. And that's a very delicious food. And it's nutritious. Well, it's the same thing. Of course, the gelatin that you buy is probably made from beef stock and is granulated, mm-hmm. but it's all the same basic substance. Mm. And of course, we always churned, and naturally, butter is more plentiful in the spring, and it's yellower in the spring when the grass is at its greenest. Mm-hmm. That's what makes the butter yellow, and then, of course, we colored it in the winter. You always used to be able to get butter coloring, and I tried to buy butter coloring last year and could not find it. I think maybe I did find it somewhere up in New York State, and they said, well, they sell it only to a wholesaler or to a retailer or something stupid. Mm-hmm. But this cow is really so good that I didn't need to color it. Mm-hmm. But we used to put butter down in gallon or maybe 2 gallon stone jars, pack it down tight, and then put a piece of cheesecloth or a salt bag, because we used to buy salt, you know, in little 5-pound muslin bags, and put a pound or two of salt on the bag on top of that butter, and it would keep. You put it in the cellar, maybe even in the spring house, and it would keep for winter. Now you could use it on the table. But it was particularly good to make cakes at Christmas time. And we used to make a great many fruit cakes, too. We'd make maybe 100 pounds of fruit cake to sell them at Christmas time. Mm. And then, of course, we put down eggs, too, when they were plentiful, put them down in water grass. And they are perfectly good for everything but boiling. And I think I have heard, and I never tried it, that if you punch a little tiny hole with a pin in the shell, that you can boil them. But we use most of those for baking. Mm-hmm. But you could scramble them or fry them. But they kept very well. And water glass, you know, is a very heavy liquid. I don't know whether you're familiar with that or not. Mm-hmm. We used to buy it at the drugstore. I don't know if you can still get it or not. But it's heavy as syrup is, maybe even heavier. It's quite liquid. And you put that in a big stone crock and put 11 times the quantity of water, the amount of water, and then put the eggs down in it carefully. Hmm. And they'll keep some months. And in the spring, when you've gotten all the eggs out, and you get them out with your hand or with an open spoon, and at the stepping stone, we have a spoon that's, I don't know if it's a spoon or a ladle, but it's open, mm-hmm. especially for getting out. No, it isn't. It's a it's like tongs, like scoop tongs, almost like you'd have macaroni tongs to get down and fish out, because that gets very cold. That is very cold in the liquid. Mm. It isn't just because it's winter that you're getting them out, that liquid is cold. And then in the spring, what's left in the jar will be liquid on top, and the residue, maybe an inch thick, will be white, clabbery, almost like not like a powder. It'll still be moist, but it'll be all thick. Now, and I suppose that's the calcium off the eggshells that is combined with the liquid. And of course, you just throw that out, and the next spring you get more. Mm-hmm. But that's a very practical thing. You put eggs away when they were 10 or 12 or maybe 30 cents a dozen, and then you used them when they were not only scarce but expensive. If you had them, you could sell them and just use the preserved eggs for cooking. And you know, people used to be able to ship eggs, which I wouldn't want to trust in the mail now, but you could buy tin boxes that held, well, probably in a variety of sizes, but it seems to me we had one that could hold maybe 3 dozen eggs, and they'd be so long, they'd be twice the size of a shoebox, and of course they'd have provisions in them. Mm-hmm. And you could put eggs in that and send them to Baltimore, and they'd probably arrive the next day, perfectly satisfactory and calmer. Mm-hmm. The handling was secure, and it was good. In the spring, it was sort of fun to go in the post office, and you'd hear little chickens cheeping, because many people, you know, would order chickens early, and then they'd have brooders, but you'd hear these little chickens cheeping away in the post office.
Huh.
I don't know whether you can still do that, or whether you'd have to buy them from a or how you see chickens advertised in the farm magazines, little baby chicks. Mm-hmm. But I don't know whether they ship any through the mail or not. But they come in boxes so deep. It was quite a thing that you'd have, and we hardly ever accomplished it because we didn't fool with the brooder. But it was considered a great thing to have fried chicken by the 4th of July. Picnics for the 4th of July, people tried very hard to have fried chicken.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Did you enjoy going to school?
Oh, yes, I was never really wild about it, but I enjoyed it. It was all right.
Was it very strict and had a lot of work to be done?
No, and I, of course, was very fortunate to have good teachers. Some very good teachers. I consider having had Dr. Hawkins as a teacher and as a principal was one of the most fortunate things, because he was a very fine teacher, a very fine, straightforward person, and didn't take any nonsense. And Mr. Miller, his predecessor, was also a very good teacher. He didn't teach me. I know he was a good teacher. He taught math. But I didn't have him as a teacher. But he was a good disciplinarian, and there was no carrying on and no nothing. And there was one woman teacher who was an excellent teacher, Miss McNutt from Darlington. She was a person of considerable stature, and she stood out in the hall, and if there was any roughhousing, she would just reach out with her hand and take hold of the shoulder of the offending person, and that's all there was about it. And I remember one time, somebody, I don't know if it was a teacher or a child, was missing $10, I believe. And Mr. Miller called an assembly and mentioned that fact. And he stood up on the stage and he said, "I am going to conduct an investigation. I am conducting it right now." And he stood up there, and don't you know, the proper person wiggled and he got that person. And I guess he got the $10 back. He was a person who belonged to a very respectable and very large family in the county, who's since died. And I guess he straightened out of it. But he didn't get away from that. And nobody came in, you know, and said, "You're persecuting my child," or, you know, it was just misbehaved. Nothing was written on the walls. And, there were no hot, yes, there were hot lunches. The Home Economics Department made soup. I don't mean particularly good soup, but they made soup and Jell-O. And I've forgotten what else. There were a few things that could be bought for lunches. Mrs. You sit still here. Mrs. Forward at that time was running Circle Inn. and a couple of the teachers, maybe more, boarded there. And if those particular teachers had study hall or had stay in at the noontime, a couple of kids would go up and get the their lunch and carry it down. That was quite an honor. I mean, I know it was like, come in. Hi, Margaret.
Hi,
come in.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Dogs have got a problem. But it's hard to lose a dog. We've lost a great many dogs. I remember we lost one dog who was bitten by a mad dog. And of course, you never know, but he was. And of course, you have to send him in, have him decapitated, and turned out that he had been. He was a Chesapeake. He used to have always Chesapeake Bays. We didn't consider him any other dog was Chesapeake Bay. But this one was Katie's, and he's not a year old. And his father was killed. Katie had his father. Billy had the mother. And Katie took this one, and he's been a nice little dog. I don't know why he wandered. Now, what do you want me to tell you?
Do you remember much about your childhood growing up around here? What it was like and what you did?
I don't know. We had a fairly quiet. You see, there was nobody else close to us. Our best friends were the Callahan children who lived across the branch from us. Dr. Callahan was their doctor always. And we were very good friends with them. We didn't do much walking across the branch. We went around. But we were very devoted to them. Mary is 4 years older than I am, and that seemed like a lot of years when I was little. I have been much fonder of her since we were grown than I was when we were there, and she went to school in town. The older son was 6 months my junior, and the younger son is a little older. He's younger than my brother, but my brother was between the two boys, but they were very close friends, always. And we played with them, but we didn't have really anybody else in the neighborhood. Whom we played with, and we had some cousins that sort of around, and our family were much older than our contemporaries' families. I've always been associated with much older people. My father and my mother were each the youngest of their respective families, but they were much, much older than our contemporaries' parents, which has it didn't bother me any. I mean, I knew it, and when things are that way, that's the way they are. Mm-hmm. But it has led me to know a lot of older people. Mr. Brooks, who was one of our oldest, longest friends, died a couple of... Hi! Come in. Come in. And this was given to me when I was little by Mrs. O'Leary, who was much older. Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Moxley's husband is just, the hinges were all...
Yeah, and they go to the top of them pieces, and he had to go to the
bottom. Isn't that pretty?
There's no way to clamp the top, so he said you just kind of pick it up gently.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, but she gave me that. There were... families have changed, the neighborhood has changed very much. But Mrs. O'Leary was one of seven Dietrich sisters, I guess. The Dietrichs came on here from Cincinnati, I think, either Cincinnati or St. Louis. They came on in the 1880s, I think, and settled themselves around here and worked Harford Furnace, you know, down on Goat Hill Road. And there was Mr. Ned Dietrich, and then he had Mrs. O'Leary, who gave me this, who lived at the Glebe on Goat Hill, Mrs. Cassley, who lived at Cassley's Corner. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not, but if you go down 543, where you take the right-hand turn to go to Belkane, the house there with the stone gatepost, the one that you turn and go past, was the Cassley's. Mrs. Walsh lived for this Eastern Christian College. Mrs. Schreiber lived right across James. Well, come back.
Yeah, we'll stop on the way back.
Okay.
Mrs. Shriver was the youngest, and she lived right up the hill across James's Road. Mrs. Doshay lived at Hamilton Park. And Mrs. Garishay never moved. She must have been one of the oldest. She never lived around here. And Mr. Clemdy, I think, didn't live around here. But they would, and my family talked a lot about them and knew them all. And they would have created quite a, and did create quite a, I wouldn't say a stir, but they made an impression on the county. And they ran that furnace until the ore gave out. Now, that, of course, you can read about it in Mr. Wright's book, and you probably have read it. Mm-hmm. Mr. Walsh apparently had the most money because he built that big house. Mm-hmm. And then when the money ran out, when the ore ran out, things sort of stopped. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Dietrich brought on with him a German by the name of Elsner, who lived across from the college in that house that sits back from the road, that white house. And Mr. Elsner farmed for them. And they even put up a library between where the Bonifaces lived and where the Gaileys lived.
Hmm.
On the opposite, right across the road from Goat Hill. I remember that. We always called it the library. And as I say, they were a family who would have done a lot for the community. Well, Mr. Walsh died rather precipitously. I don't know what killed him off. He had a son who did not contribute to the community. And Mrs. Castley had two sons and a daughter. Mrs. Shriver had a son who lived in Baltimore. You might have looked up here when he was little. Mrs. Doshay had a son who I think did not actually discover scarlet fever serum, but he did something of a very considerable medical importance and worked with the Russell Sage Foundation, but it was a deal in New York. I assume he's dead, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But they were a big contribution to this little area.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, old Mr. Strasbaugh lived where the Bonifaces lived. And he had Cresswell's store, I think. Cresswell, of course, has always been a store. Then there was a store at Harper Furnace. And Mr. Tom Oliver had one of those stores. The Glebe on Goat Hill started life as being the rectory for Spasusha Church at Perriman.
Hmm.
But that, of course, is down the neck, and there was malaria there, and they built that house was built for me. That's where the Mackenzies live. You know, Mrs. Mackenzie writes the food articles in the Aegis,
hmm.
and Mr. Mackenzie writes something about stocks or whatever.
Hmm.
But that's the Glebe. Hmm. And Mrs. O'Leary, who lived there with her two daughters, I don't think Mr. O'Leary was living when they came on here, gave me this.
Hmm.
And she had... which had three daughters. One of them was Mrs. Strasbaugh, and then she had two unmarried daughters. One, I think, was an artist and lived a lot in New York. And then the one who lived with her, they had a 1915 Ford touring car, and we bought it from them. But before we bought that car, they used to come along and take us to Bel Air, for rides and so on, and we used to go to Bauer's Bakery, which was about where Georgetown North is, somewhere in there, and Mrs. Bauer and her daughters, her last daughter died only a year or so ago, she was Mrs. Emily McComas, and they had just the best oatmeal cookies. I remember them very distinctly, and I remember Armistice Day, when the Mrs. O'Leary and Miss Judy came along and said, Armistice has been signed, come on, go to Bel Air. And I remember the banners, the courthouse had an iron picket fence around, I remember the banners. I always wondered how they knew the banner, how they had the banners ready to hang. But I remember that. And they were very, very pleasant, very good people. Mrs. O'Leary was quite an old lady then.
Hmm.
And who else? There was a wonderful family who lived, if you go all the way down 543, and I don't know whether you're familiar with that road or not at all, the Harper Furnace Road, and don't turn to go to Belcamp, go about a quarter of a mile farther, go past the road that goes into the forest, which I think is called Carson's Run Road. a delightful family from Baltimore came out and built a house for the summer, and then finally lived there the year round, and they were the Kirklands. And they were very, very lovely people. Mr. Kirkland, Mrs. Kirkland died, I think, shortly after I was born. I don't remember her. I remember Mr. Kirkland and his three unmarried daughters who lived there and who were some of the charter members of the Garden Club, and began to, I remember they were the ones who suggested and promoted having a flower mart in Bel Air in the 30s, and were exceedingly delightful, pleasant people, and they lived there until but they were exceedingly generous, lovely people. You know, some people have it and are generous, and some people are not. Mm-hmm. But they were exceptionally lovely people and delightful to have around. And then they went to Baltimore when gasoline became very hard to get and more expensive. And they just, well, Miss Bessie had died, and Miss Clara and Miss Daisy went and lived in an apartment on Charles Street. But we missed them. Nobody took their place. And who else? Well, of course, we always went to the mill. We had, we took wheat and corn to the mill, and you know that the game was that you took your bag of grain and had it ground, and the miller took out the toll. He didn't pay it. He took out so much for grinding, and it was always fun to go in the mill. You know, a mill, the floor of a mill is always so smooth. Nothing polishes. There's no professionally polished floor that has the smoothness that a mill has. Of course, the floors are thick to begin with. They have to be heavy. The boards have to be thick and tight. But the beams of a mill, I can remember, have always been just so nice and smooth and soft and pretty and noisy. And there was a mill at Calvary, which some unspeakable creatures burned down shortly after the war. And we went there mostly. Various and sundry people ran it. I don't know, Mr. Millard Wright ran it one time. And when we went there, Mr. Pruski, Mr. Henry Pruski, who was a Bohemian, a very fine person. His father could hardly speak any English. But Mr. Pruski was a very nice person, nice to do, and always had such pretty pink cheeks, you know, as the Czechoslovakian people have. Mm. And we went to that mill, and there were other mills around. Well, it was Hooker's mill, and of course that was burned too, and then Hooker's, the covered bridge at Hooker's was burned. But that was, I don't know whether we ever went there for flour. I know we've gone there and had maybe feed ground. And in the spring, we always went to Havengrass or Lapidum and got herring and brought them home on a Saturday and soaked them in brine, tubs of brine. And then by Monday, they were ready to hang up. You run the sticks through the eyes, you know, and hang them up and smoke them for several weeks, and there's nothing quite as tasty as smoked herring. It's they have a lot of bones, but that's no problem at all. They're just delicious. And the smokehouse burned down because it had some magazines stored in it, which really shouldn't have been there, some 10 years or so ago, and that burned, so we can't smoke herring, can't smoke the hams, which is a chore. Oh, I mean, it's an annoyance that we've got to farm out the hams, and they won't be smoked, really. They'll be done. Well, when we had them done 5 years ago, we took them all the way up to Dallas down, Pennsylvania, which is 50 miles. And they smoked them, but they weren't as if they had been smoked for weeks. And we smoked them with apple wood or with hickory wood and covered with sawdust to make a smudge. You don't want to, of course, we don't have a flame. But that's good eating. And then after we smoked them, we took them down and wrapped them in newspapers and put them in burlap bags and hung them up in the maple tree. And they would last, you know. Of course, they get moldy, but hams are supposed to get moldy. And they would last. And of course, some people used to put their hams down in bran, the kind of bran that you feed to hogs, you know, which is it's also, I think, called chop. It's the grain and the cob ground up together, I think, and some people, I think, buried their hams in that. and some people cure their hams with wet, in brine, wet salt. Mm-hmm. And we always did ours just by rubbing them with salt and brown sugar and a little salt here and so on. Mm-hmm. And there's a knack to it, and I never paid much attention to it. I didn't have to do it, and I didn't pay much attention to it. And then when we did it 5 years ago, and I had to do it, I was only mildly successful, but mm-hmm. It turned out I could, I guess, improve my technique. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember, would you go into town in Bel Air when you went to get things that you'd have to buy, or?
Not too often, because there was always an adequate store at Crestwell and also at Calvert. Oh. And we went there. I remember the Crestwell store, I guess the Calvert store too, it probably was a very common thing, had a frame with holes in it that was on the porch, on the store porch, and that was for buggy whips.
Hmm.
And you could drive right up to the Crestwell store. The Crestwell store burned. I can just barely remember that. I remember the man was working for us, Johnny Brown, who died just about a year ago, running down the road to the store, and I was very little. And I remember Dad saying that he begged Mr. Rogers to build the store farther back from the road. And of course, the road was not very wide then, and he used to be able to drive right up close to the porch, the store porch. But he built it right up on its own foundations. And then Mr. Rogers sold to Mr. Ed Hamby, who ran it for quite a number of years, and sold to Arlie Rice. And several years ago, Arlie tore it down and rebuilt it farther back from the road. And I used to, when he did that, I thought, well, Dad told Mr. Rogers to do that more than 50 years ago. But it had to wait until Arlie tore it down and redid it. And now it seems as if it's close to the road, but it's not right on the corner. The gas station's on the corner, but the store used to be. Mm-hmm. And then the Calvary store was, we always went to. And the stores always used to have big cases with candy, you know, big rounded cases. Mm. There was a store in Bel Air where the Red Fox is. Do you remember when when Preston's burned?
Mm-hmm.
And that was Preston's store that had those triangular steps, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was little, that belonged to a cousin on the downside, Cousin Sally Ewing. And it was a stationery store, really, but. And she sold linen paper by the pound, and I guess colored, well, I don't know, people didn't use colored paper much then, but I know she sold pound paper and envelopes.
Mm.
And she sold beautiful china. Not whole sets, I guess, but it was Limoges or Haviland china, and we have several things that I'm sure have come there, sets of bread and butter plates and such.
Mm.
But she sold rock candy, which I have not seen since. And it's not the rock candy that you can get. I saw some was called rock candy at the Carroll County Farm Museum the other day. And I've seen it up at Landis Valley. But the kind of rock candy that Cousin Sally sold was like chalk. And it came in pieces like big bars of Hershey chocolate. Only it was white, and you just break it off. But it was the consistency of chalk, and very good. Of course, it was pure sugar, and delicious. Mm. And we always had some on the top shelf of the kitchen. But I haven't seen that kind of candy for many, many years, and I certainly didn't miss it. I remember that rock candy and horehound candy. We always had horehound. Horehound was good when you had cough. Always had horehound candy stuff on.
Mm.
I still have some horehound. You can get horehound, but you can't get the rock.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a very nice little store that she had. But we didn't go to Bel Air a whole lot until we were going there to school. We went there, of course, but not as often.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the jail used to be where the county office building is. And it was a nice-looking the store, the jail front was the sheriff's house. And it was a nice old white plaster house with a front porch and a nice yard. It seems to me it had a picket fence too. It was certainly more attractive than the county building. And I just shudder to think what the new courthouse is going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's going to be an atrocity.
Well, what do you remember? What the Masonic Temple? What was that like? And when it was?
The Masonic Temple was a very fine building. Well, of course, it's been down only a few months, and I've been in it many times because it had that fine auditorium upstairs, and we used to have some school suppers there. And because when I was first in high school, we did not have an auditorium. We had what we called the Assembly Hall, which later became the Manual Training Building, but that was just a frame building at back. I don't think it's there now, but it's at back of the school, tore down from the grammar school. What the Board of Education was the grammar school. The auditorium was not built. They enlarged the high school in 1928, I think. But I'm not sure they built the auditorium then. Maybe they did. But when we had school suppers, we had them in the Masonic Temple, upstairs. And I've been to a great many Red Cross meetings there. And we've had school parties there. The Masonic Temple, I think, rented for $10 and the Army for $18. And we had commencements were always in the Army. Junior senior banquets were in the Army. Because, as I say, we didn't have an auditorium, and everybody was perfectly happy by it. I feel that I've been exceedingly fortunate in knowing as many people, as many groups of people as I do, and I was sort of surprised that not too long ago I was talking to a person who's much older than I am, and he knows a great many people and knows them well. And yet, the scope of that person's acquaintanceship is narrower than mine. And I thought, how do I know so many people? But I know them a lot of different ways. And I remember some of my neighbors who used to speak of one of their relatives who lived in another city, and they said, Cousin so-and-so has several sets of friends and she never mixes them. And that's all right. There are different people appeal to you in different ways, mm-hmm. and they might not get along with each other at all. Mm-hmm. But I get along with them and I enjoy them very much indeed, but I wouldn't mix them all up. Mm-hmm. But I know a good many people through the church and through county organizations in the church. And not only through my church, which is St. Mary's at Emerton, but my mother's church was the Churchill Presbyterian, so I know all those people, I mean all those original people, some of whom are still living, very well. And I've gone there off and on all my life. I haven't been for many years, but we used to go some Sunday afternoons, the Calvary Methodist Church would have services, and we used to go there sometimes, especially if we hadn't been able to get to St. Mary's in the morning. We'd go to the Sunday afternoon service there. Mm-hmm. And so I've known groups of church people. I've known the Red Cross all my life long. I remember, of course I didn't personally do it, but I remember sewing and working on things for the Red Cross in World War I. And after World War I, it was called, we sold for the Armenians, and then there was the Near East Relief. Well, I'm not sure if the Near East Relief was Red Cross or Church. The Armenians were Red Cross, I'm sure. But I've known all the Red Cross areas. And before the war, before World War II, there were 18 branches of the Red Cross in the county. And there might still be, only they're not called that. I don't know what they call units or something stupid. And Mrs. Otha Lee, who lived next to the Red, where the Red Cross building is now, and who was a remarkably kind person. She had been a teacher. She was a woman of pretty nearly 6 feet tall, I think. A lot of presence, a lot of personality, a great deal of sense. And she was the executive secretary of the Red Cross for quite a number of years and was an outstandingly fine person. And I guess it was her idea that we have monthly meetings. Well, we met, I don't think we met in January and February, maybe, but from, I think, May through October, we met through the county. The first Monday or the last Monday, I've forgotten which, every month. And we met in different people's houses, occasionally maybe in a church, but generally at a house. And I remember one of our neighbors saying, did you ever notice that where we have the meetings, the people generally just painted their house? But, and I know that some people went to those meetings to get to see the houses. And because often they were houses of of considerable size and elegance. Mm-hmm. They had to be of some size, but often they were of considerable elegance. And some people, I'm sure, went to see the house, and maybe some people went for the cake and punch. Mm-hmm. But it was a very nice thing to do, and we had many reports. The meetings were much more interesting than the meetings are now. Every branch chairman had the opportunity to say what her branch had done during that particular month. And one old lady up the country was a very poor speaker. She was a wonderful little woman, and her branch did a great deal. But her reports were poor to listen to. I mean, they were inspiring, all that she did, but she spoke very poorly. And this is digressing a little bit, but quite a good many years later, there was an adult education class in public speaking in Bel Air. And we were asked to say why we were taking the course. And my brother said he was a person of strong opinions, and he'd rather be able to convince other people than to have to change his own. And I said that I was taking them because I remember this little old lady whose reports were so not unpleasant, not agonizing, but I just wanted to be able to speak better than she did when she made a report. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether I achieved that goal or not, but I often think of her. We had a wonderful chapter secretary who was the mother of Wilmer and Paul and all the rest of the Cronins in Aberdeen. Mrs. Will Cronin was a beautiful secretary. She stood up there just as erect as she could be and read these beautiful reports that were given in subliminally, whether the people went for the tea and cookies or whether they went to see the place. It had an effect, and we had a banner Red Cross chapter, and I got to know a lot of people and a lot of places and a lot of little old roads in the county. Mm-hmm. That way. And I also during the early 40s, I drove Red Cross people to the clinics in Baltimore, which was quite an inspiration. It was quite an experience. I did not mind doing it. It was on the area around the Hopkins Hospital. It was not very good then, but it was certainly far and away better than it is now. And it was a very interesting experience. I never had any unpleasantnesses. One woman escaped me, and she had asked me to take her across town to her sister's afterwards, and I said, no, I wouldn't. And I didn't follow her around the clinic, and when it came time to go home, she did not show up where she was supposed to be, and by George, she had gotten across town to visit her sister. And I came home without her and raised considerable sand about that with somebody, and I remember taking one old woman who entertained me with the glories of the cars that her grandsons had, and I came back and raised sand about that and said if that old woman's grandchildren had so many cars, they could jolly well take grandma to the clinic. But those were interesting, and that taught me a lot about the county. Uh-huh. And then I haven't been to too many Farm Bureau meetings about the county, but I at one time was on the board of the Farm Bureau, and I knew a lot of the people. And that was very pleasant and interesting. And it's just nice to know different groups of people. And now I'm into Stepping Stone, the museum board. You know, I've been in that since it began. I said to one of my very good friends, not many years ago, I want to go to Virginia such and such a time. And she said, oh, no, you can't do that. And I said, well, I wanted to do that, and that suits me or whatever. And she said, oh, no, you've got to go to that Stepping Stone meeting. It's going to be an organizational meeting or something or other. Well, it worked out. I don't know why I gave up whether it just didn't work out that I went to Virginia or whatever, but I went to the organizational meeting. And I got elected secretary. This friend who was persuading me not to take the trip, having been on the nomination committee, and I've been secretary of the thing ever since. And I've gotten into it, it seems to me, more and more deeply. You know, it began up at Mr. Ed Bull's, up on Macton Road. Mm-hmm. And I was interested in it. I mean, I used to go up there and guide on Sundays. And then when Mr. Bull died and Mrs. Bull eventually sold the place and we had to move, we went down toward Rockland, you know, and adjacent to the park. And I seem to spend a fair amount of time down there. I don't spend as much as a lot of people do, but I've been down a half dozen times this season. Mm. I was down there yesterday, and it's very interesting that, of course, the people who come are interested in the first place. Mm-hmm. I have never guided per se at the Stepping Stone, because last summer, which was our first summer down there, Mrs. Schillinger was running the guides and doing a marvelous job. And she asked me if I would do the Rockland House one Sunday or Saturday, and I said I would. And I think some people figured that it was more glamorous, or they knew more about doing the museum or whatever. And at any rate, she asked me again, and then I got so that I felt so wedded to the Rockland House that I did it more than I did the museum. I've been to the museum on special days, but I haven't done just the regular guiding there. But some people have labored very long. Many, many people have worked very hard over that place. There's been a tremendous lot of work to do, and there still is a tremendous lot of work to do. And then we've had that big campaign we're in the midst of this spring, and I did some mailing for that. And I like it. And the people who come to Rockland House, where they don't have to pay at all, because that belongs to the state, but some of our museum things are in it. So we run it sort of in conjunction with the museum. Mm-hmm. But I like it. And then I have been to the museum, and I was just crazy for us to get a stove. Because we do have a kitchen over at Mr. Paul's house, and we got a nice kitchen stove. And then I was very eager for it to get underway, and they finally got it hooked up. And last September, I think, on the, I think they call it the fall harvest days, I went over there and worked in the kitchen all that day and all that afternoon and baked pancakes, and everybody came in was invited to have a little piece of pancake, which they seem to enjoy. And I've done that on several occasions since then. I was over there yesterday, and we had a group of school children. We make pancakes and we make butter, and the children lap that up. And the children are pretty receptive. We've had a number of groups from the county and from out of the county, and they have been pretty good little kids. And it's an interesting thing to do, and I've enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. Mm. And I have lately done considerable house sitting for people. And that's pleasant. It's a responsibility, but it's very pleasant. The houses I've stayed in have been pleasant houses, and the dogs and I seem to get along. One of them slept with me during a thunderstorm last year, but that was all right. Mm-hmm. And some of them have slipped away from me a little bit, but they've come back. I haven't had any unfortunate experiences, and I have several assignments this summer to do for people. Mm. And it certainly takes me away from my own house, and my own house certainly shows it. But it's rewarding monetarily, and I, as I say, I enjoy it. I get to see different parts of the county and people, and so it's I like people. There's some people who I certainly can live very happily without. But the people whom I do deal with and do with are very pleasant people. Mm-hmm. And they've all been very nice to me. Mm-hmm. And it's easier. If you don't resist people, you get along easier.
How did you get involved with the kitty shop?
Well, Lucy Worthington had it, you know. And she called me up one day and said that somebody who was working there was going to leave. I don't know if she was going into teaching. Maybe she did. For school or something or other. And would I like to work for a little while? And I said yes, so I showed up the next day, I think. And I worked there 18 and a half years, I guess. Lucy sold it to Mrs. Morgan, who was working there when I went there. And then I worked there until she retired. I went there the September, or I don't say September, it was the summer of 58. And Mrs. Morgan sold it in February of, she gave up the shop in February of 77. And it was a very pleasant experience, and I met a great many people there. And I liked it, and most of them were very, very nice people.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, when you graduated, I guess you were right in the midst of the Depression.
Right in the midst of the Depression, yeah.
Was that a very difficult time around here?
Well, I don't think I was too aware of it. I may have been living in a pleasant fog. When you live in the country, you live, if you live right, you live a fairly self-sufficient life. And I didn't know that things were as hard as it, I mean, if you've always been careful and frugal, and you have a reasonable amount of food, and you're not in the habit of going chasing off, and we didn't spend the money on entertainments and trips and whatever anyway, so we didn't do it during the Depression because we'd never done it before the Depression. Mm-hmm. And it did not affect us consciously, as far as I'm aware, as much as it might have. Mm-hmm. I know people are in straitened circumstances, a lot of them were, and they were regressing, but they didn't have the grand ideas that people do now. They weren't so high up that they had far to drop now. They didn't have two cars. And in a way, things were easier. I mean, as far as transportation was, there were any number of buses besides the Ma and Pa in and out to Baltimore. You didn't have that problem. And we made most of our trips to town. And my mother had a sister in Baltimore where she went very frequently, and we went on the bus. It was perfectly convenient. And when you go to town, the streetcars and the buses were very convenient. There was no problem. Mm-hmm. Day or night. Mm. You didn't think anything about it. And some of our best friends lived just around the corner from where my aunts lived. And you go there and go up, you know. Did I tell you, I said this to somebody. I didn't say that to you this morning, did I? Didn't I say it to you yesterday? Very recently. I guess somebody I saw yesterday. You open the door and say, anybody home? And they'd answer from the far reaches of that big three-story house where my friend still lives. And now when I go see her, she has the outside vestibule door locked and the inside vestibule door locked. And she has iron grillwork on the front windows. And she told me several years ago that when I rang the bell to step back on the steps so she could look out the window and see who it was. Hmm. And several years, not her, but other people whom I visited in that area would say to me, stay to supper, and I'd say, no, thank you, I have to stop uptown and see somebody else. I did not say I'm not going to be in this area at night. It was reasonable. be pleasant living going and visiting.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go down and visit people. I had friends in various areas of town, and I enjoyed seeing them now and again. Mm-hmm. And our friends would come out here and stay. And during the war, my brother was deferred for farming, but we had several friends in Baltimore who would come out and stay with us for weekends or maybe a little longer. And we'd ride around, and we always found that if you took rides through the country and on side roads, and most of the roads then, or many of the roads then, were unpaved, people always thought they'd had a much longer ride than if you were riding out on the highway where you got somewhere very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And they enjoyed it, and we enjoyed it. And there's a fire tower up in Calvary Woods. It's called the Stony Forest Fire Tower. I don't think it's manned now, I'm not sure. But we used to go out there. There wouldn't be anybody there in the summer, but we'd go out there and climb up in the fire tower and sit there and look around and look at the lights. I think I might have been up there once in the daytime, but generally it was night, which was pleasant. You can see below you as you climbed up.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see Route 40. Of course, Kennedy wasn't built, but it was nice to look out and see the lights around about, and that was a pleasant, simple little thing to do. The Harper County Fair was quite an event in the county for many, many years. It was always in October, and we got off on Friday, I think, from school. Thursday was considered the big day, but I don't believe we got off on Thursday. We got off on Friday, and it was, of course, there was racing with it, too, which I didn't know much about, and that didn't interest me, but the exhibits were good, both the livestock and all the crafts, which were not quite as much as people do now, but they were very interesting, and the Granges, there was an exhibition hall, well, there is an exhibition hall at Timonia, but the Granges would have booths.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many Granges there are in the county. Of course, I've never belonged to the Grange, but I've always known the Granges.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, I guess, pretty stiff competition among them. But that was always interesting. And then all the jellies and preserves and all that stuff that people exhibited in their handwork. And there were many, there were some sideshows, and then there were people selling things. And just the most wonderful thing, you know, things that I've bought at the fair. There would be housekeeping things, you know. I have a needle cutter and a watermelon baller and a peeler. I remember getting that. I remember the pitch the man would make, you know, how wonderful all these things were. Well, of course, I've used them for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And there'd be demonstrations of equipment. Both farming equipment and household equipment. I remember seeing an ironer demonstrated and thinking I could iron three times as fast as that ironer did. But all those things were interesting, and there used to be gypsies at the fair, and you had sort of carrying anything. You wouldn't want to put it down. The gypsies were right fingers. But it was interesting to have all that to do. And there'd be, of course, all the equipment tents, and then various groups in the county would man the food booths, I think. Some of them might have been commercial, but I think some church group, I've forgotten which, always had soup, and I've forgotten who all had things, but they were, it was more native done, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw lots of people. It was a very interesting thing. And then, of course, in the spring, we had the field day at the fairgrounds. The schools play each other all the time now. They don't have one big day, but they're always having competitions, you know. But this was a Saturday in, I guess, May. And they had grammar school and high school, and the Public Athletic League, PAL, would come out from Baltimore as referees. And it was quite a big day for the games and the track and so on. That was very much look forward to. It was a good day. And then the races came to Bel Air, and I guess maybe August. And that was where the Harford Mall is, you know. And there was a beautiful oak tree out there, which was the heading on the all the letter paper of that, whatever had to come out from the fair and so on. And I think the people who, the fair board, the original fair board, I expect some of those old upcountry people, I don't know if you've done anybody who's talked about the fair, have you? Have you done anybody like Mr. Wilson Hughes?
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say anything about the fair?
Some.
Because he would have been in it. And, but the original fair board, I expect, did write well. I mean, they had stock, and I don't remember who they were. If I'd see the list, I probably would know it. Know who most people were.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was a board with stock, and I think they probably came out all right.
Mm-hmm.
Not as well as the people who had stock in the Havergrass Bridge. That was a real bonanza, you know.
Now, what happened there?
Well, that sold stock, and then that was a toll bridge. And those people, and I can't tell you who they were or what, but I know that that was a big deal. If you were doing, well, I expect Bill James could tell you, because I would imagine his father was in it. And who else? Mr. Poffenbach, maybe, from the Havergrass. I don't know if you've done any of those people or not. But you ought to do Mr. Poffenbach, because he's quite an old man and would remember a lot. Well, Wilmer Cronin and... oh, what's the Cronin who's married to Laura Hanley, and I know his name perfectly well. Anyway, those Cronins in Aberdeen can tell you all that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a real bonanza. People really cleaned up on that bridge.
What about the Chautauqua? Do you remember that?
Well, I never went. I remember when it came, and I was fairly young, I guess. And that was a very cultural enterprise. I don't know if you call it being on a lecture circuit, but those people would come and have very well-known speakers, and they would give plays. I think they'd come and set up for possibly a week or maybe 5 nights, and concerts and so on. It was quite a thing that people looked forward to. Started as Talk in New York, and that's why they called it Talk. But that was quite a thing. And then there used to be, I remember during the war, the Churchill Presbyterians used to have vesper services. Now, I think that was during the war. It might even have been sooner than that, but might have been more during the Depression, but I think it was the war. And then before the war, there'd be outside Sunday evening services and so on. And people were not as sophisticated. They were glad to go to something that was pleasant and interesting, and they didn't have air conditioning, and they didn't have television. And they were glad to get out and mingle around. And if you didn't have, you never had air conditioning, it didn't seem hot. And the older houses aren't as hot anyway. I remember when the first air-cooled movies came, and they would have on their marquees, they'd have big signs saying it's cool inside, and they'd have pictures of icicles dipping, you know, and they were very comfortable. I'm sure many people went to be cool. But there were a lot of meetings, and of course, before I can remember, there were tent meetings, various and sundry places. I've heard them talked about, but I never went to a tent meeting. There were Bible meetings in Cooktown, up at Cooktown, you know, that was a camp meeting place. And they used to have camp meetings many years ago. Up around Calvert, there'd be camp meetings, which I've heard about, but it was long before my time.
Mm-hmm. Who are some of the outstanding people that you can remember in Harford County? Is something, if you were to say that.
Well, Mrs. Oakley Lee, certainly. Well, of course, I knew Judge Preston. I don't know how outstanding he was. He's a judge.
What was he like?
Well, he was a handsome person and a courtly person, as of course all the old men were. And he was a judge for quite a number of years. Who else?
Do you remember the Miller Tigers?
Yes, I remember him.
What was he like?
He was an entertaining person to see, and a good speaker. And I think I voted for him. Sure again.
What about Colonel Archer?
Major Archer.
Major.
Well, I went to school with his son, Bobby. He, I'm sure, did a lot for the county. He was a good wangler. He could arrange things for the betterment of Harper County. And who else was in Bel Air? The old Websters. I can barely remember. I remember Charles Peverly's grandfather Harrison, who was an exceedingly important person. He did live where the Crown's oil, Shosh owns that, on Bond Street, you know, the big Harrison house was there, and then that was made into apartments, and Harrison was built the first house on Choice Street. Mm-hmm. Mr. Harrison was a very delightful person. And then where the Acme was a Hunter house. Mrs. Harrison and Mrs. Hunter were sisters, and they married uncle and nephew. And then Mrs. Hunter's daughter was Mrs. Griff Lee. Griff Lee was quite a character in Bel Air. Very careful with his money, and a lawyer. Of course, Dr. Vandiver was down at what is called the Vandiver House, you know. Then there were a great collection of Richardsons. Dr. Charlie Richardson lived where that hideous, is that Vermont Savings or no? The ironic thing is that was a nice old house, stone and frame. And they tore it down and built that on speakly ugly land. Mrs. Ellie Fulford's house was a nice yellow frame house, I think. Just a nice enough house, nothing spectacular, it was a good enough house. They tore that down and built that beautiful Loyola Federal, which is prettier than than Mrs. Fulford's house, although there's nothing objectionable about that. Mm-hmm. But that, the tear down Dr. Charles, and of course it was a dreadful scene to tear down the Country Club Inn.
Yeah, where was that?
That was where motor sales was. Mr. Hanna tore that down, I think, and put up motor sales. Mm-hmm. Motor sales used to be on the other side of Bond Street, because when Mrs. Hanna stopped teaching school, she's still living, you know, down at the big house on Ring Factory and Tollgate. It's what Mr. Hanna referred to as his little bungalow or his little shack or something like that. But Mrs. Hanna taught sixth grade, and she gave up that and went in and helped him and made that business. And I remember seeing her sitting in the office on when it was, I guess maybe that's where the First National Drive-In is. And then Mr. Hanna tore down the Country Club, which was a lovely old building, and had been a wonderful inn for a long, long time. It had had its seedy times, but it was still a very nice place, and built the motor sales, with which he made a great deal of money. And, of course, Bill Childs bought it and did all right, and then he built down the road. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Kenmore Inn was where the Safeway is. Mm-hmm. And it did pretty well, and was nothing outstanding to look at. It was a two or maybe three-story yellow frame mansard roof, I think. Nothing spectacular, but a perfectly civilized place. Mm-hmm. And I, of course, they couldn't serve liquor. Well, nobody else could serve liquor either. But there's no place in Bel Air, really, that's a place for a big party, mm-hmm. which the Kenmore was equipped for, and the Country Club was equipped. Not a great big party, but a nice one. The Bel Air people had never gone in for big parties. Mm-hmm. They'd never gone in for dress. They just thought they were, and I don't argue with them, that, you know, they were ladies and gentlemen, whether they had on their sneakers or whatever they had on, and you went to see them, and they entertained in their own homes, however they wanted to. Mm-hmm. But it didn't occur, I don't think it ever occurred to Bel Air people to put on a big splash, as it occurred to some people in some parts of the county, to put on a big to-do and a big car. Bel Air people have never gone into big cars particularly. I mean, some of them have had big cars, but it hasn't been a big thing. It just hasn't. They just felt, you know, and the Harford Boat Club, of course, was the social center of the county, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was right down on the, when you cross Route 40, you go down through Emerson, through Abingdon, cross Route 40 and keep on going.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes, excuse me, you bear off to your right. And it was in there. I think some of the buildings may still be there, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But the boat club was quite, and I never went there during its real heyday. I've been there once or twice, maybe once to a card party. But it was a very social place.
Mm-hmm.
And they had dances down there, and that was, I guess, the Bel Air Club, really.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not there's prohibition, I'm sure there's a lot of drinking down there.
Mm-hmm.
Bel Air has never really been what you call a dry camp, regardless of what.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, during the prohibition, there were great many stills throughout the county, too.
There were?
Oh, my, yes, indeed. And there was a lot of leaving liquid tokens on the doorsteps of people from whom favors were expected and desired and so on. There's a lot of talk about that. I don't know any specific instances, and of course I was fairly young then.
Uh-huh.
But there was a great, great quantity of bootleg liquor consumed in the county.
Hmm.
Bel Air has never been one to not indulge its thirst.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of good living in the county.
Well, now, how different was Bel Air from, like, Aberdeen and Havre de Grace?
Well, it was different. It was, as I say, they just went along, and they could be very well-to-do, and they didn't bother to show it. I mean, if they had it, they had it, but they weren't making a big to-do. And I think the Aberdeen people were more for wanting to show. And they had made it. They had it honorably. Those people canned, and of course that canning was a tremendous industry in all over the county, but especially in Aberdeen. Aberdeen had the railroad,
mm-hmm.
and that did a great deal. It had two railroads, and that did a great deal for it, and those people were more inclined to work very hard. But they made their prosperity known. And they were more for, as I say, showing it, you know, the best of them more, and so on. And Bel Air was the movie. And various and sundry people have come into the county, and some have done a lot for it, and some have not. And some have not only contributed to the county, but have received from the county. And some have done one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And the developers have, I don't know, you just assume some of them hadn't come.
What do you think about all the Edgewood Joppa Town in that area? Was that all, that wasn't like that too many years ago?
Oh no. That's sort of, and of course that's the tail swinging the dog now, really. Because that's a very heavy population, and those people are very vocal. And they're getting into positions in the county. And there are a lot of people in the county who ought to be in politics, who ought to be leading and doing things, and they're sitting back and complaining, but they're not getting in there and doing anything. Which is unfortunate. Every now and then I'll say to somebody, why don't you get in politics? Oh, I wouldn't get in all that mess. But these fellows who come in from do you know where are getting in and fighting and fussing and getting the jobs and getting things done, whether it's right or wrong. Dr. Kelly's mansion is going into Parks and Recreation now, and I hope that will be successful. Of course, it's a very beautiful house. I've never been there. I've always wanted to go, and I'm sure I could send Peggy any time. I'd like to see your house. But I never have. But I hope that that will be successful and help the house, help the county, for the town at least. And some people have worked very hard. Dr. Kelly's grandson is one of the ones who's worked very hard to preserve the environmental aspects of the county in that area.
Could you suggest some people in the community that would be good to interview for this? You had mentioned Mr. Papenbeck and Havlicker.
Yes. Have you done Miss Martha Michael up the road here?
No, I was thinking about her.
I think she would do, because she has put her house, you know, her farm, into the trust, so it can't ever be developed, and she's very proud of that.
Mm.
And she's had very warm relations with the men who, I think they're out of Baltimore, who have worked with her on that.
Mm-hmm.
And she, Mr. Hill and his historic register, I guess he was working for, has photographed her house, and he says that there are architectural aspects of that house that he hasn't found anywhere else. And he's photographed that from garret to cellar.
Hmm.
She could, now I don't know how much she would tell you, but she could tell you a lot. Mrs. Brooks could have said a lot, but she wouldn't, because she just died a couple of weeks ago. She was 92, and perfectly clear in her mind, absolutely clear. Mrs. Holden Rogers could tell you a good deal about her part of the county.
Yeah, we got her.
You got her. Mm-hmm. Did she tell it like it is?
Yeah.
And then there are upcountry people. I'm glad you got Wilson Heaps. And who else is up there? I don't know if any Davises left or not. The Davises used to be. Dad and Davis used to be. They had, Guernseys and Jerseys. But they had very fine cattle, cows up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know who's left in that part. Have you got done any of the Wysong men?
Yeah, let's see. Richard, Wysong,
and Richard,
and
Richard and Frank and Jack.
No, he's not done them yet. They're under, you know, people have suggested that.
Yeah, they could all tell you a lot, because they have roots deep in the county and have been very honorable people.
Hmm.
Who's in Darlington?
I was thinking about Jim Ewing.
I was just going to say, we've done Jim Ewing.
And then Esther Yeager.
Oh my God, yes. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, Esther would tell me. And her brother, Mr. Will Silver, probably would tell me. Who else is up there? Mr. Scriven, who lives next door to Esther, is not a native, his wife is, but he has made a great deal, I mean, he knows a great deal about the county, historically and so on, and would be absolutely accurate anything that he would tell you from his research. Do you know him at all, Reverend Mr. Scriven?
Yes.
I've known Isabel, always. I think she might be a little smidge younger than I am. I can't remember when I didn't know her.
Mm-hmm.
Her grandfather used to have a store at Abington. I was a very good friend of my father's, and he used to visit him. They moved, Mr. Jimmy sold his store. I moved up to where Isabel lives now. Isabel's father died when she was quite little. I guess he had TB, I'm not sure. But I've always known Isabel.
I was wondering about, I don't know how you're related, Miss Hope Down?
She's my brother's widow.
Oh, I see.
Have you done Paul Beatty Hall, the church there?
Yes.
Of course, he knows a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And is accurate. Of course, a lot of people would ramble, but a lot of people, some people are accurate.
Uh-huh.
Who around Bel-Air is good? Have you done Mr. Wilmer Barnes?
Yeah. we're going to do him.
Yeah, because he knows a lot, and he's accurate. And Mary Wright, of course, knows a great deal. Mm-hmm. And each of them might tell you other people. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Barnes, well, both of them have up-country connections. Mary does, I think, maybe more relatives up there. Mm-hmm. I don't know who's up in the Jarrettsville, Norrisville area. Maybe Sam Ford. Maybe some of the Joneses, Durans. Now, those upcountry people could tell you. I don't know. I know those people's names, but I don't know them. Mm-hmm. But there are, those people have lived up there for a long time. Mm-hmm. How about Mr. Edwin Harlan, who lives out on Pleasantville Road? Mm-hmm. I think it's Edwin. He's one of the Harlan men who lives on. Do you know Pleasantville Road? Mm-hmm. And you know that house that's very close to the road, just before you go on down, go to the hill, go down the hill and cross the gunpowder.
Is that a big red?
No, it's a frame house on the right hand side. It has shrubbery. It's very close to the road. Mm-hmm. The barn's very close to the road, mm-hmm. And that's Mr. Harlan, and he would know a lot about.
Is he the father of Edwin Harlan, the judge? Or?
No, no. He may, I'm sure he's a distant relative, but he's not close. And I don't know how much Buddy Harlan knows. He might know from general absorption. Of course, his father died when he was pretty young. But he might know. John Carver certainly ought to know as much as I do. He's a little bit older than I am. Do you know him?
Let's see, is it Margaret Carver?